comes Irving. Drives on Thompson. Irving spins. Puts up the shot. It's good! Kyrie Irving with 3.4 remaining. And the Warriors call timeout. Irving does it again to the Warriors. Porter can't find anybody. He gives it to Wall. Working against Bradley for three. John Wall! What a shot!
He just plays the game, but I'm not going to let them treat us that way. You know, I know Pop's got pedigree and I'm a young rookie. But they're not gonna rook us.
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 They're not gonna rook us. They're not gonna rook us.
Would you like to hear some of my basketball takes?
I'd like you to introduce the podcast. Who are we?
No, that's not my job.
Unnamed person.
Who are we? What are you doing in my house?
Yes.
Why am I listening to you? It's a live podcast where we just turn up people and we talk in your kitchen for a while.
Yeah, it's pretty much the
until you tell us to go away.
This is the
aesthetic
that we've developed over the years. Is basically we are drinking beers in your kitchen at your house party. And you don't really know who we are, but you start listening to what we're talking about. And perhaps you're interested, or perhaps you tell us to get the fuck out your house. That's kind of the go. This is the Bulls podcast. I'm the Doc. He's Bezo. We've been doing this on a variety of online formats for many years, and at some point someone suggested you should do this at a podcast, and we said, that's an excuse to create a new internet product that'll take up weeks, hours and hours every week. Why don't we do that? So we did.
Well, we used to do a bit of blog stuff against each other, you know, riffing
blogging,
off each other, but
yeah.
The joy of this is that we can drink at the same time and talk.
We can sledge each other in real time. I don't have to wait for your comment to come up on the... I don't have to wait for posting. Sledging. Real-time sledging with beer. This is the 112th episode of the Bulls podcast.
Wow.
And it is the season for transactional shit in the NBA, which is another reason we started this podcast, was because we found ourselves both talking shitloads about the National Basketball Association on various formats and discovered that maybe us talking shit about the NBA was a thing people wanted to hear more about. And we have not been disproven in that. That's all we need. We are two white guys with a podcast. We don't need any encouragement to continue.
As we talked about last week too, we're not the fucking worst take in the basketball universe.
There are many a worst take. And many of them come with a fucking Disney imprimatur on them.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what, Howard Beck and the guys on the Full 48 got stuck into some of the hot take merchants in their brethren today. So
I mean, there was a sea of takes after game five. The NBA finals were finished, folks. Yeah. If you've been living under a rock, the Cavs won in five. What alternative universe is this? The Dubs won in five.
2016.
I think I was thinking the Dubs will win the next five, is probably what I was thinking.
Yep.
And then that cued a sea of shit takes from the LeBron ain't clutch to the LeBron ain't MJ to the one that I was the most disappointed by, which, because it came from so many intelligent NBA writers all at the same time, decided to write that thing you think is bad is actually good, which is the Dubs are actually good for the NBA, dominating the shit out of everything. There's nothing I hate more than a contrarian take for the sake of a contrarian take. But the fact that there was five of them that did it all spontaneously at once really gave me the shit.
Well, I think that's because I think that was a real pushback in that. And this sort of feeds into one of the things I wanted to touch on this week. But I think that was a real pushback on the, everyone just thinks they went out and bought for, like, all NBA players. And that's not the case at all. Like, the Cavs have had more higher draft picks, a bigger salary, and more big-name players go through their roster in the last 3 years than the Dubs have.
They grew there. The Cavs flew there.
Yeah. Not entirely, but...
Yeah.
But the Cavs have definitely had more dips at the lottery fucking pot than the Dubs have. Like, what's the Dubs' highest pick? 7, I think. Is it 7 or 6?
Well, they didn't turn it into anything. I mean, none of the players they have are a result of a strong lottery pick that they made. They've traded for them, obviously. Mm. But Draymond was second round, and I don't know where. Where was Steph was kind of.
I think 9 or Steph was 7.
Oh, was he 7?
Steph was definitely 7. Which is because, ridiculous. Or 8 because.
He wasn't thought highly of out of college.
Well, the 3-1 joke, the joke with Steph is always that Minnesota took 2 point guards before they took.
And it looked like a lot of other clubs wouldn't have taken him anywhere near that anyway. It was just that the Golden State were high on him. He could have easily fallen further than that. And then that's kind of the thing about the draft. The draft is coming up next Friday because this, as I said, this season of transactional shit continues, even though the finals have finished. The draft is next week, and then a free agency starts on the 1st of July. It doesn't depend. It's not really a question of what you're worth. It's a question of who needs you, who has need for your skill set.
Yeah. Well, and that's the other thing about this Golden State team is it's not just 4 really good players. It's 4 really good players that fit together. Like, you know, we've been banging this for the last couple of weeks. They fit together really well. You can't just go out and get the next 4 best players in the league and put them in a team. Like, Westbrook and Harden now, as they are currently sort of developed as players, won't fit together because they both need the ball a fucking lot. And neither of them particularly are keen on giving it up. Mm. So, but what I wanted to talk about, was...
But that's actually a good point. Can I just pause on that? Because OKC did probably did a better job of that drafting and pulling everything together than Golden State did.
Okay.
But it just so happened that the players they pulled together, as they developed, became less and less a fit for each other.
Well, this is what I wanted to talk about, right? So take OKC versus the Dubs. And I think there's a real comparison here. So the Dubs and OKC both drafted really well. You would agree? You would even say that OKC have probably drafted a little bit better on pure talent than the Dubs have over the last 7 years since Durant was drafted, right?
Oh, for sure.
You look at the key points. The Dubs overachieved in that they lost to the Clippers in that. It wasn't the conference finals, it was the round, it was round 2 of the finals, wasn't it? So that's like it.
Which one?
That was the year they lost, the year they fired Mark Jackson.
Oh, excuse me.
That was round, it must have been round 2 because the Clippers have never made
It was the Clippers round. I thought that was round 1.
It must have been because the Clippers won, so they must have lost in round 2. Yeah. So it must have been round 1. But like that was the year where everyone was sort of like, "Oh, Golden State, you know, maybe they're going to be something." So at that point, Golden State assessed and went, "We've got this good young team with good talent, and our coach has taken them to a certain point, but we're pretty sure that he's not going to be able to take them to the next level." And they fired their coach and got someone else. You look at Oklahoma City. They got to that point where they made the finals, got smashed, but just rolled it back again. Didn't have the.
Well, they didn't quite because they shipped out Harden, did they not?
Yeah, well, that's the point. And this is the other point is, you know, Golden State when it came to going and getting Iguodala, their owner, who we can both agree is a bit of a douchebag. Basically went to his GM.
On the scale really of owner douchebags, he's not. He's just a loudmouth.
Yeah,
he's a loudmouth. He's not foreclosing on poor families in the Midwest like Dan Gilbert is. So he's not that bad.
But the point I'm making is that he went to his GM and his staff. If you think Iguodala is the guy that you've... Because you remember the trades they made for Iguodala were sort of seen as very high risk.
They were.
They took on a lot of... They got rid of a lot of picks just to ship those players out that they could ship out to bring him in. That was seen as a real high-risk move.
I mean, and the trade for Bogut was, you know, I think that they didn't give away perceived equal value when they got Bogut. They gave away more than they brought in. But as it turns out, they were parts that... And, of course, success makes you post hoc justify everything. So everything looks better in hindsight when you win, and it all looks like a genius master plan that probably didn't ever actually exist. But
at that same inflection point where OKC could have kept Harden, their owners basically said to their GM, no, you have to keep salary under control. Like everyone rags on Presti for sort of always trying to move into the future and like, you know, turn an asset into younger people and stuff like that, a little bit like Philly Light. But the fact is that he's being instructed to do that by his cheap ass owners. So if you'd had owners that went, look, if we really think we've got three top 10 players and we've got a chance of making another run at the title, just pay fucking Harden whatever we've got to pay him and we'll work it out later. And then go and get a coach that can say, okay, Harden's going to be, you know, Harden's going to take some offense off Westbrook. Westbrook, you're going to become Chris Paul. You're going to become a two-way, high-intensity player who can basically make life miserable for the opposing point guard, because Harden's going to do this offense and Durant's going to do this offense. But Scott Brooks was never that guy.
I think all of that assumes that Westbrook could ever have worked with Durant and Harden in a format where all three of them need the pill. And I just don't believe that exists. I think that it was never going to work. It wouldn't. And Scott Brooks is a good coach. It was never going to work. And that's why Durant is in San Francisco now. In Oakland, technically, but it will be San Francisco as soon as they open the new building, because Durant figured out he couldn't work with Westbrook.
Well, this is my other point.
The MVP of the league.
So, if you're a top player, and I'm talking like top 12 player, so you know Westbrook, Lillard, all those sort of guys, right?
You're being generous to my man Dame. Thank you for that.
No, I think he is in that. I think he's in that bracket. But I was just thinking about this the other day, like, because a couple of the pieces that I read about Durant, and there's a lot of, you know, the text message stuff and all that, that's just waffly bullshit. You don't focus on that. But the thing I focused on, that Lee Jenkins piece, is the fact that Durant actually improved as a player this year. Like, he learnt stuff that he had not learnt before to do. Like, and I'm not talking about he added an extra two meters to his 3-point shot, or he learned to dunk better or something like that. He learned a whole heap of little skills that make you a better team basketball player. Now, if you're a top player and you essentially dominate the way your team plays because of your talent, how do you improve? I really don't know. You have to have a really fucking strong coach that comes to you and says, Dame, mate, I'm gonna send you off to, I don't know. We're gonna hire Tony Allen, and Tony Allen is going to teach you to be a pest defender. And you may not become Tony Allen, but you may become a two-way player. Like, you may really improve to become a two-way player rather than just an offensive force.
So he's gonna teach him pest practice.
Yeah, but
the best case scenario is that he becomes a really good defender. But you didn't hear any of that, but our listeners will thoroughly appreciate the comedy that I just brought there.
Oh, wow.
You're the pest around. No one's ever going to keep you down.
But, like, can you see Westbrook is – all the improvement that Westbrook is making is just becoming –
Westbrook is 1992. It condensed into the form of a human being. He is the NBA in 1992. And so is Kyrie Irving.
His skills, like, the way he gets better is getting better at the things that he already does. He doesn't add skills. And this is what I find amazing.
You mean
about
like
LeBron,
Kyrie?
Because, yeah, like, LeBron's game is actually more well-rounded and wider than what it was when he left for Miami.
So he's fired. Oh, folks, just breaking in here for a second. Fantastic Instagram post from Dwayne Wade, who was killing social media at the moment, of him the day he turned up to Team USA training with his shaved head. And Wade gives a transcript of the conversation between him and Bron. So Bron saying, I'm never going to shave my head. I'm just gonna keep rocking these waves until the last minute. Basically saying, you're bald now, son. You're going to have to deal with it. And it was so great. I will put that in the show notes. Yep. Note to self.
There's, The Warriors may have won, but the NBA is proving once again that it just rules the social media roost, because the sort of half snarky, half petty social media war between Draymond and LeBron today has been pretty good as well.
Whatever, Draymond.
Draymond?
Whatever.
Oh, look, he definitely keeps a lot of reporters employed, mate.
He's great in context. I'd love to know what he would be. And I hate to give that, you know, go win on your own like a real man stuff. But, you know, he's a part that works brilliantly in the context that he's in. I don't know what he'd be like if he wasn't in that context, given that nobody else ratted him. He was a second-round pick. He's very much a spark plug that only works in that particular sort of motor.
What he is he's Sean Marion without the ego. Because Sean Marion's problem was that he was Draymond, but he always wanted to be Steph Curry. And Draymond is quite happy being Draymond. Do you know what I mean? Like,
the background reading for this part of the podcast is 7 seconds or less by, what was it? What the dude's name? Who wrote 7 seconds or less? This joke would work better,
wasn't it?
If I can remember what he's. Oh, it was Jack McCallum, wasn't it?
Jack McCallum. I'm pretty sure, yeah.
By Jack McCallum. This joke would have worked better if I'd remembered the name of the author.
That book is amazing because, like, I try and pretend.
I'd call
that
it a textbook, non-ironically. It's a textbook for like everything that's happened in the fucking league since, hasn't it?
Pretty much, yeah.
I'm not
a, you know, passionate fan, and I sort of dispassionately enjoy the league from, you know, just a pure perspective.
Yeah, I was just talking to Rudy Edsel about that because he hosts the Destruction of the Boss podcast, and I said, you know, I was talking to someone else and saying it's a really good podcast despite being hosted by former Mad Victory fans who can't hide their bias, and he was a bit upset because I just kind of put it out there. No, we can tell that you guys love Victory, and the listeners can tell that you love the Suns, but that doesn't fucking matter because this is not ESPN.
Well, and the other thing is,
we're about as employed as most of ESPN.
It's not like we have to talk about the Suns that much.
And the reason you can tell it's not ESPN is that it's fucking listenable sound quality.
And, man, one particular.
Also, we
one
say
of
cunt.
Their guys, Well, that could probably improve their podcast. It's so obvious that Windhorse is just a mouthpiece for LeBron's camp now. You know, the narrative that he's pushing out on some of those pods is...
Windhorse was always a... he's in with them. But I think he pisses off LeBron's camp just as much as anybody else. I think because he was...
Yeah,
him and McManaman wrote a book about them. He's always going to be seen as that. No matter what, so he might as well just lean into it.
Yeah. So anyway, I enjoyed that last game of the NBA Finals. I thought it was a good game.
It was all right. It's a game. I mean, the problem is that it's a bit Stockholm syndrome. We've had so many bad games that a game that you know is like 10 points apart for most of it is kind of I suppose this is competitive.
I pretty much knew it was over when I looked at...
It was over when we drew teams in fucking October. We knew this wasn't going to be a contest. And the whole year we've been kind of couching our enjoyment of the NBA against this likelihood that the finals were going to be Cavs versus Dubs and the Dubs would win and it wouldn't be close. And that's what we got, but we still had fun along the way.
No, it was the third quarter and I was having a look at the box score at work and... Durant had like 23 minutes and LeBron had 35 minutes and I'm like, yeah, I'm pretty sure that they're going to run a lot of stuff for Durant in the fourth quarter.
And Durant ISOs and pick and rolls with Steph were the money. And why wouldn't they be? Because as we've said for weeks that ISO ball, while inefficient in a regular season game, because everything else gets taken away, your ability to ring it around the perimeter with abandon goes away from you. ISO becomes a high leverage solution. And that's why Kyrie is much more useful in the playoffs. He's much more important in the playoffs
than he ever is in the regular season. Though Kevin McHale had an interesting point this, and like I don't think this is exactly what he was saying, but I'm going to take it that way, is he sort of ragged on Cleveland.
You could put that in Latin, that would be the fucking the motto of the podcast. It doesn't matter what the experts say, we'll just take our own fucking interpretation and run with it.
Well, no. He said something, and I'm going to agree with it, but I'm going to take it one step further. But he basically said, post the All-Star break, Cleveland rested by cruising through games, by not putting much effort into games.
For sure.
Now,
LeBron racked up huge minutes, but they weren't. He was basically standing around.
Yeah, they weren't. And what McHale said was, if you know that the end game is to play Golden State, then you've got to play like you're playing Golden State in the regular season. Now, the problem is you can't do that and still get to the finals in good thing. But what they could have done, instead of doing it the way they did, was do it the Spurs way, where you play flat out today, and then you rest LeBron and Kyrie tomorrow, and you lose that game. You would have won and lost the same amount of games, but you would have actually played at a decent intensity for more of those 40 games that you just cruised through in the second half of the season.
The lack of opponents that are capable of mirroring what you're doing is the problem. But even within a game, play flat out for a quarter. Situational shit.
Come out in the third quarter and fucking wipe the floor with them. Decide that we're going to run a particular style. We're going to do this and we're going to do that. I don't know. It's really hard for the Cavs because the fact that they can just beat anyone pretty much in the East with their hands tied behind their back does make it hard for a coach to stop you being complacent.
Well, I like Kevin Pelton's comp when he pointed out what the Cavs need to do was to be like the Australian soccer team. And it was a comp I came out of nowhere. I'm like, how do you know about us? And they said, no, the Australian soccer team moved into Asia to get competition. And I was like, that's true. And how do you know? Fucking computers, man. How do they work?
That's right up there with, I was listening to one of my pop culture podcasts, and they occasionally do an 80s movie. And they were talking about this, and I've got a real soft spot for American sort of teen comedies. I just don't know why. I just like them. And they were talking about this old John Cusack teen comedy, which I'd never seen. I was like, oh, this sounds pretty interesting. I go and watch it. Now, this is set in, I think, 1982 in college. Like,
is this the one where he's got the boombox sitting on the car?
Yeah, I think so. Is that 16 I think it's that candles? One, right?
I don't know. All those John Hughes ones kind of meld into one, to be honest with me.
Okay, but you know the craziest thing is he rocks up to a lecture wearing an Australian Kangaroos rugby league jersey. I was just like, I'm still baffled by that. What the fuck? Who was on the cast there?
Some wardrobe person is having an almighty fucking in joke, just saying. Text back to Mal in 1984, telegramming Mal and saying, I'm going to get your jersey on.
Like, I could sort of understand a Wallabies jersey because rugby is a more international sport.
But not in America. 1980. No.
Yeah, but not in America, but even.
Are you sure? I mean, like, did it have the kangaroo?
Yes, absolutely. A freeze frame. It's, you can't mistake it, mate. It's the dark green with the yellow Vs with the kangaroo. It's like a. It's either a classic or a Canterbury jersey. It's like old school, proper rugby league, heavy knit 1980s kangaroo jersey.
In an era when they wouldn't have sold them as merchandise because they didn't really sell jerseys as merchandise in those days. I mean,
I'll get a screenshot for you.
But I don't think they sold. I remember, when I was a kid, you could get New South Wales rugby league jerseys. You can get your Parramatta and your Canterbury and all that sort of shit. But that's. I mean, back in those times, it was quite the green and gold was a little bit more sacred. I'm not even sure if they sold them back in the early 80s. That is amazing bullshit.
It just absolutely blew my mind. I had to stop and freeze frame it and go, am I hallucinating? And I showed Vanessa and she's like, yeah, whatever.
It's, yeah, because chicks, mate. Chicks aren't interested in our shit, mate. You know, that's why we have no female listeners, mate.
Research scientists are probably not that interested.
No, just
rugby
anybody
league.
With a brain is not interested in rugby league. That's why men like it. Anyway, poor old rugby league. So, I am sick of KD to the Dubs backgrounders. I think we've had enough of those. I don't care anymore. I don't care who texted who. It's done now, as is the
so
NBA
what's...
until the Warriors break. And I'm sick of White House invitation takes. I don't care if they've been invited. I don't care if they've said no. It's just a fucking charade anyway.
So what's the most interesting postseason story? Is it what the Clips do you reckon?
Well, the Clippers have signed up Jerry West, who of course was the GM who underpinned some of the really cool stuff that the Dubs have done. And the most important thing is, of course, Jerry West is the logo. He's the dude on the NBA logo. And this is the first time the Clippers have had a logo that hasn't been shithouse for a very long time.
Very nice. He's also not afraid to shake things up. And if anyone was going to advise Ballmer...
And that needs to be done.
To just blow the... You know, to blow shit up and start again.
It doesn't even necessarily need to be blown up. It just needs somebody who's willing to blow it up and to go in there and make an absolute cutthroat razor assessment of, does this work? Will this work? How will this work if this ever will work? And if it doesn't work, what do we need to get rid of? And just make some ruthless decisions like, Blake, you can fuck off to Miami. We don't need you. Or whatever it is that needs to be done.
Oh, man, I really want to see Blake go to Miami. I reckon he would have a second career resurgence there. I fully believe that.
Yeah. See, I don't think his career is dipped. Clippers, I mean, right? He was brilliant for a lot of the regular season while he was around. But
I think they lack in a little bit of the off-field stuff. Like, I wonder whether some of their fitness stuff is their injury stuff is fitness and the way they treat their players and the way that they operate. Because Simmons has always made snarky jokes about, you know, Doc Rivers on the golf course and stuff like that. And you take that with a grain of salt because he's got history there. But I also saw
Simmons was a season ticket holder. So, you know, he's got a right.
Yeah, that's right. He's seeing...
He's not just coming at this as a media personality. He's coming this out as somebody who's actually got a tiny equity stake in the business.
And also probably has a fair bit of insider knowledge to how it's run. But I also heard a lot of stuff about players rocking up for trainings late and coaches rocking up for trainings late. And look, we've talked again and again that the NBA is so cutthroat that if you're slack on that stuff, you got no chance. Yeah. You got fucking no chance.
If you're 2% off, forget about it. You'll end up... I mean, where did they finish this year? Fourth? Third, fourth?
Fourth. They finished fourth in the West because Utah beat them at home in the last game. So,
and they were almost equal on games won and lost with Utah because it was pretty close in the end who was going to have home court advantage. They were, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I'm going to say they were 20 games back from the Dubs.
From the Dubs
and if
and
they
Spurs.
Weren't... They would have been if the Dubs were trying. So and the Clips were trying all the time. So they are that far back in terms of actual
ceiling. And then there's the fact that the team that is going to dominate the West for the next couple of years basically treats you like it's a little bitch. You know, it's like having a big brother that's 6 years older
not
than you, and every time you
with
play cricket
that term, Mr. Baisley. I don't think you should use that.
Okay, well, I'll make a better analogy. It's like having a brother that's 6 years older than you, and every time you go down the nets and play cricket with him, he bounces the fuck out of you just because he can.
And now we're getting into... Now we're getting... This is not your therapy class. Sincerely, the brother who was six years older.
I'm an only child, mate, so
I couldn't bounce my brother because he was more interested in fucking surfing, so that wasn't really going to help me. I mean, really, yeah, as you say, realistically, the Dubs are not going to lose for any reason other than health or ego-led explosion of the team. And A is possible, B is unlikely.
Yeah. Not while Kerr's there, because I think Kerr's...
Even while Brown's there. Brown did a fantastic job as a, coach of the year, as we suggested the other week. He did a fantastic job of holding it together.
Well, the other interesting thing I find about the Dubs is they have very little separation between their front office and their coaching staff.
For sure.
Like they all work in the same building. You know, if a coaching staff member has a good business idea, they can go to the business people. If the business people see something that, because they're slightly outside the bubble, they can mention it to the coaching staff. Like, I think you described it sort of half sarcastically as, you know, a real Silicon Valley sort of work environment. But
well, no, that's more the owners. Works. The owners are like Silicon Valley tech bro fucking douchebags.
Mm.
But that's, and so are the fan base. But that's not an indictment on how the operations work within the building. And I think they do have a very flat management structure. They have the GMs and your Bob Myers and your Steve Kerrs. There's not any great steaming hierarchy where decisions come down from on high and the coaches are constantly bitching about management to the players and the players are constantly bitching about coaching to management and vice versa. I think, as we said the other week, Bob Myers and Capri Pants rebounding for Draymond, that indicates that they are all in this together. Not to sound like Ben Lee, but they are all in this together. Whereas I think a lot of other teams, Phil Jackson is going to be down there rebounding for for Porzingis. He's just not. Capri Pants or otherwise.
No. Well, and I saw one of the Golden State bloggers sort of throw this out there that what Kerr and Bob Myers both do very effectively is when things go wrong, which haven't really gone that wrong, but still they did lose from 3-1 up, we should remind people. When things go wrong, they're very quick
to... They don't get reminded
nearly
enough.
No. They're very quick to apportion the blame to themselves and the way that they, you know, the fact that they should be dealing with their business better. But when there's success, they're very quick to deflect the success to someone else. That's hard to do with jobs that high up. It tends not to attract that sort of person. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It tends to attract the sort of person that wants to have their name in Time magazine and wants to, you know, and just speaking of the difference between Golden State and Cleveland, how the fuck does a guy take a side to the finals 3 years in a row and not have a job?
Yeah.
GM still doesn't have a job.
Yeah, David Griffin still doesn't have a contract on the table because Comic Sans Mans is an asshat. I can only assume that he's trying to squeeze him to the point where there are no other offers and he can get him down off whatever value, whatever price tag he's asking. But
man,
this is not a way to get goodwill out of your out of your client base. This is not a good way to... What's the fucking point? It can only be
does consulting for a year and turns up somewhere else. I mean, maybe the Clippers.
The subtext seems to be that maybe LeBron doesn't like him, but what do you want?
No, I don't think so, because
with the parts that he's got.
I think I said last week that no GM has lasted more than like 4 years at the Cavs, and none of them have been fired. They've all fucking resigned.
Or not had the deal picked up.
Because
Dan Gilbert, folks, in case you've missed it, is a cunt. And you don't want to work for him. And I don't want to work for him. LeBron doesn't want to work for him, but he happens to own the only team in his hometown. And coming back to play for his hometown was the only way he could stop the entire state that he comes from burning effigies of him in the streets.
I do like how, the intelligent basketball writers are just so switched on both of them, because there was that little tidbit in the Sloan conference interviews that David Griffin gave about the first round picks that they dealt and how they're top 10 protected. And someone went back and listened to those interviews and they basically sound like, well, It might have been that LeBron knew that they knew LeBron might walk after 4 years, and then if those picks are in the top 10, we'll get them back. And if they're not in the top 10, well, we've still got LeBron, and it doesn't matter. But yeah, it sort of seemed like Griffin was planning on not having LeBron till the end of his career.
Yeah. And fair enough, too. I mean, he left once, he can leave again. And as we said a week or two ago, if he leaves a second time, there's not going to be the backlash. There still might be a local backlash, but there's not going to be the backlash from outside Cleveland, because they're going to go, no, you fuckers had you go. You got the most out of him. He's done more than enough for you, pricks. You can go fuck yourselves.
You got a championship. Yeah. You are the most tortured fan base in,
bunch of spare
in American history.
That's the thing they say. Oh, no, there's a bunch of all-stars on that team. How do you think those guys got to be all-stars? They weren't necessarily all-stars before they were all-stars before they played with LeBron, but it wasn't because they were on winning teams. It was because they were racking up good numbers on shit teams that were never going to win anything. Both Kyrie and Kevin. Love had never
made a finals, no. Had he? He'd never made a finals.
And Kyrie hadn't either, because Cleveland were fucking garbage. That was how Mike Brown got fired the second time.
Mike Brown. I hope Mike Brown's still drunk. I really do. I hope he's just
sending his fucking invoices, his substance invoices to Dan Gilbert, because he's still under contract there. There was some ridiculous fucking tweet from the NBA Australia account saying the Cavs Dubs will do whatever it takes.
I was the one who retweeted
writing
that
a check for all the money.
Like, seriously, NBA Australia, you could have the Doc and I run your account, and it would be more fucking intelligent than whatever numpties you have running the account now. Look, you can even run our podcast under the NBA Australia account. It would be more intelligent than the shit you're putting out now. Like, they're treating... If you're following the NBA Australia account, you have a basic knowledge of the NBA. Of course they're going to give Steph Curry the max. The only reason they wouldn't give Steph Curry the max is if Steph Curry walked up to the front office and said, I'll take $10 million less than the max.
Yeah. Which might be what Kevin Durant does. Maybe, or I will take it over a different stretch of time, or I'll load it in a different way, so that you can keep the band together or something like that. But Steph Curry has spent too long earning two-fifths of fuck all, and he deserves to get fucking paid now, particularly given that Under Armour have died in the ass and all his stock options are worth $2.50.
Well, this is the point that Howard Beck made about we should appreciate the Warriors. How many alpha stars?
That was number 973 in the series of... The Dubs are actually good for the NBA. You're not allowed to get upset about them winning. I think
Beck's got a little bit of credit to be able to pull this take off. But his point was
you are the number one in the card carrying fucking Howard Beck fan club.
Yes, they're the only writer I like at least as much as Zach Lowe.
Is it true you get the other half to dress up in with glasses and turn like Kobe and say, what up, Beck, to you? Is that what happens? Sort of cosplay you guys get up to?
I know they don't listen to this podcast, but that would be hilarious if they did. His point was, how many two-time MVPs are going to let another guy walk in and basically make them the second banana? Anyone?
And whoever has a second banana. I mean, I have one and I feel a little bit queasy because they've got a weird texture. When I was a kid, I once threw up after having a banana. I've never really been the same about them. Which is odd because
You grew up in the north.
This is the irony. My mum grew up on a fucking banana farm.
You slept
farm.
On a bed of bananas.
Yeah, my mum grew up where they grow bananas in northern New South Wales. So.
Hang on. How can you not like bananas? Bananas are awesome.
I love bananas, but if I eat one that's a bit overripe, I get kind of a nasty gag thing going. I'm like, oh, this is like eating my own sick. This is getting a bit deep in my psyche. I'll take you back to a really dark time I had once in preschool where I had a banana that was overripe and I threw it up and I got in deep shit and I had to stand in the corner for an hour. And it was really, what? This is bad. They smacked my bottom. Anyway,
I think I like your singing better.
Here's the thing I'm really wondering. They're talking about giving Steph the max. What is the max actually worth? And I looked this up. So, Max Verstappen earns $3 million per season, plus incentives, plus bonuses. Mm. So they must be earning at least as much as him when they're talking about giving him the max. Unless what they're talking about is giving you the rights to Max Verstappen. So if you get the max, you get Max Verstappen or the cash equivalent and everything he wins for the course of the year. Is that collectively bargained?
Is that called the Verstappen clause?
It's the max.
It's the max.
Well, you get that or a crappy fucking, you get Max Headroom, which is just a bad puppet at these days.
Oh, dear.
Zach Randolph looks, so you're like saying... Max Verstappen, looks a bit like Max Headroom. Mm. Just rounded off like the latest Twitter update.
So, Le Mans is on right now, you were saying.
I'm watching the replay of qualifying, but there's nothing on right now. Qualifying's okay. All
so,
done. Now,
so
there's
when,
been
when
a,
is it?
There's been some insane shit go on. So, in 1970...
So, just,
sorry, what were you going to say?
Just wind it back a little bit for me.
I went back to 1970. What do you? How far back do you want to go?
It's a 24-hour race.
Yes, it is.
But they have
3 2-hour qualifying sessions leading up to it because it's really important to take pole position for a 24-hour race. Vive la France!
But when do they start and finish? Does it finish like an early morning?
PM,
does it finish at lunchtime?
3 p.m. French time. So it works out to be about 11 o'clock Australian time, about 1 o'clock. New Zealand.
Okay, so what's the? I've always wondered about this. What's the strategy? Because they have what, three drivers?
Strategy
two drivers
these days is go like fuck for the whole time, and hope that you don't lose time. Because it used to be, you know, cradle the car, you know, change up gently, just, you know, baby it. Now it's flog the shit out of it for 24 hours, and if something breaks, get in the pits and fix it, and hope for the best. But go out there and flog it harder.
Okay, so, but what about, like, obviously it's slower. Is it slower driving at night? Much slower or just a little
bit? Well, here's the thing. It's cooler at night.
Like, is it,
This is the height of,
though?
Well, part of it isn't part of it. It's lit. Fire emojis. But what it is, okay, so it's dark, but in the heat of the day, it's like 30-something degrees because it's France, the middle of France, you know, central plateau fucking France. In the middle of summer. At night, it's cooler, air's thicker, more power. Car can go faster. In fact, the pole position, the qualifying sessions they've been holding are usually in the late afternoon or in the night. And it's actually, the engines can produce more power at night. It just comes down to whether you can see or not. So it's, the night doesn't make you any slower. It is basically an all-out sprint. The thing that stops you is tripping over back markers and having to spend time in the pit lane, having bits stuck back on your car. And that's kind of where they are right now. So last year, you remember possibly that there was the Game of Thrones ending, whereby Toyota were finally going to break
their
back
.
After years and years of trying and failing and trying and failing. And they got to... I saw you tweet while this conversation was happening, you bastard. I know you're not paying attention.
Well, it brings up, no, that's my next
mind
point
you, I've
I'm
been, I've
get
been
to.
Tweeting.
Yeah, no, that's why I did it.
I'm going to put my hand up. I'll acknowledge that. I've got two hands here. I can hold a microphone with one and talk with the other. I've had practice.
I'm live tweeting my next topic.
Oh, God, is it that kind of... Call in if you're interested. 1-800-FUCKWIT. But
you've
so
lost
Toyota died in the ass on the literally crossing the line to start the last lap. Died on the it was like unbelievably cruel. They've come back and they're not taking fuck off for a hint or an answer. They've come back with three cars. They are demonstrably quicker than everyone else, and they have got better fuel economy. And they have taken first, second, and fifth on the grid. But in doing so, their lead guy, Japanese guy Kobayashi, set a lap that was less than 1 second slower than the fastest ever lap around Le Mans. Now, the fastest ever lap around Le Mans was set in 1970 when there were no chicanes on the big straight. They have a straight that goes for a couple of kilometres. And now there's chicanes on it. Ah. Back in 1970, there were chicanes. And this dude called...
So it's like 30 seconds faster over the whole lap sort of thing.
And it was in a Porsche 917, which is like a legend of Le Mans. It was like this ridiculous, low-slung, 5-litre, flat 12 monster. It killed as many people, as many drivers as one in it. But it was just an astonishing piece of kit. And he set a 3-minute 13 lap around the old Le Mans. Kobayashi went out there with all the chicanes, with all the corners that have been tightened up for safety and all the rest of it, and set a 3:14.7. And that's probably the fastest lap that's going to be at Le Mans for a very long time, because I guarantee the FIA are going to go, you guys need to slow the fuck down. We're going to take away all your stuff. We're going to make you run more wing. We're going to take your boost away. We're going to take your fuel away, right? Because we're not having this shit.
So I guess now the only question is, can the car last 24 hours?
And they've got three cars this year. It's the first time
If the car lasts 24 hours, they've got it won.
Well, basically. Yeah. I mean, this is the first year Toyota have brought three cars for probably more than 20 years. They've got strength in numbers. Porsche have only got two cars this year because they've been hit by the Volkswagen Dieselgate thing. I hate putting gate on the end of stuff, but that's what it's been called in the papers, which is the reason Audi aren't here at all. So Porsche have only got two cars, and they're not particularly quick, so they're just going to do the tortoise stuff. They're just going to do their own thing and hope for the best.
So who else is there, manufacturer-wise?
Well, in LMP1, which is the top-end thing, it's only Audi, it's only Porsche and Toyota, which is part of the reason why they've announced new rules where they're kind of cut costs and they're going to simplify it a little bit. Still keep all the technological stuff and the hybrids, but they're trying to get Peugeot to come back because Peugeot pulled out in like 2012, I think, 2011, 2012. Bernie TB will correct me on Twitter. But Peugeot have always said, we'll come back when it becomes cheaper because we just can't afford this shit.
Okay, so hang on. You said there's two Porsches and three Toyotas, and they're the only two. You're saying there's only five cars in the race?
There's 60 cars in the race, but there's only five in LMP1, and they are, you know, 5 seconds
away. Right, so they run like three categories at the same time.
Yeah, so LMP2 is almost like a privateer formula where they've all got the same engine, and they've got a choice of four different chassis, and that's mostly privateer.
So how often does an LMP...
Just a two. Call it a P2. P2 car.
How often does a P2 car win the race? Because
never.
The top five
it's
cars just break.
Because this is the smallest LMP1 class for a while, and it wouldn't be that surprising to see a P2 car make the podium. But it's because they're so much quicker over a lap, it's just not going to be the case that...
All top five cars have to break, basically. Yeah. But five cars breaking in a race of 60 cars where you're obviously lapping people and it's in the dark, and like that's not out of the realms of possibility.
But you can drag it back to the pits and get it fixed
and then just go out and lap the other guy.
Because you're still going to finish 20 laps ahead. Mm. So that's kind of the cool thing about endurance racing is that you've got these kind of heroic recovery stories. This, you know, the thing blew up and it's got, you know, it's got like one wheel hanging off it and bits thing, and they drag it back on the starter motor.
And...
Well, they can't drop another engine because that's against the rules, but you can drop pretty much everything else and you drag it back on the starter motor and they're in the pits for an hour and a half and they get it back out. As long as you're running at the end of the race, you get classified and you might actually win it. So, but that's why Toyota got fucked last year, because even though if they'd been able, they'd finished more laps than a lot of people who got classified. You know, if they'd finished that last lap, even if they'd been miles behind, they would have got fifth. But they never made it round the last lap in time because there's like a 20-minute limit on the last lap. And that was kind of sad for
them. I know I've asked this before, but what racing has the most manufacturers in it in the world?
I would say GT3, because every, well, not every manufacturer, but a hell of a lot of manufacturers have got a GT3 car and some kind of factory-assisted program.
Like, are we talking Kia and Hyundai and...
I'm not sure if Hyundai or are we still like, but certainly Toyota have got one through Lexus, Nissan have got one,
Subaru
have got one that goes in the same class. The Japanese Super GT, Subaru have one that goes into that, but Subaru have always been more interested in rallying.
Yeah.
But all of the Europeans are in there, the BMW, Audi, Mercedes, Porsche, Lamborghini, Bentley, you know, Aston Martin. Corvette, you know, this go on forever. More people shitless.
See, I've always thought the V8s, like, if they're going to open it up beyond Ford and Holden, that what they should do is try and get every single manufacturer that exists to run a car. So that you know, no matter what car you had, like, you know, I drive a Mitsubishi Ute for work. Oh, there's a Mitsubishi in there. I can support the Mitsubishi.
Well, I mean, what they're trying to do is have like what they would call a silhouette formula, whereby you get like a basic chassis, a basic structure, and you just hang body panels off it that looks like a certain car, and you put an engine in that belongs to that family of car, and you go racing, and that's basically what the rules they've got now. That's why you've got the Nissan Altimas and the Fords and the Holdens, and the reason that the Volvos and the Mercedes dropped out is just commercial pressures. It was just because they weren't, you know, the companies changed their minds about being involved. But the rules were fine. Mm. That wasn't a problem. It's just there wasn't that appetite to be part of the sport. But I think, and what's going to happen with the Generation 2 V8 supercars is that a lot of the technical stuff is based on GT3 stuff. The engines they're going to run are basically going to be GT3 engines, which is going to simplify things a lot. I mean, the V6 twin turbo that Holden are talking about running, I think is basically the engine that Cadillac have been running in their GT3 in the States, because they've got like a GT3 VTSR or whatever their fucking thing is called. So it's basically how it's going to work.
Well, that's like my second cousin is massively into sprint cars.
And that's something that second cousins often do, you know.
Yeah, that's true.
Second cousin Billy Bob's into sprint cars. Ding, 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 ding. Okay.
But they often used to get, so like, you know, there's a big American sprint car circuit in the States.
Shit, yes.
And quite often the Australians would, like the really top Australian teams would get last year's bodies and engines from the States. Yep. And then
that's exactly what happens with the GT3s. So the Bathurst 12-hour, you can't turn up in 20. If you started at the start of the 2017 Bathurst 12-hour, you couldn't bring a 2017 car. You had to bring a 2016 car, because of that. The Australian race is mostly built on not hand-me-downs, but you can't run a current year car because that's not fair, you know. And even at Le Mans, there's two classes of GT. There's the GT Pro and GT Am, and GT Am has to have year-old cars because the idea is they don't want factories coming in and dominating.
Yeah. I like that. I can always remember the Top Gear episode where they were talking with, was it Kimi Räikkönen? One of the Finnish, who's the older Finnish Formula One driver?
There's been a few. Was Nicky Rosberg?
I'm sure it might. I'm sure
Mika Häkkinen.
No, I'm sure it was Kimi.
Mika Häkkinen was.
Might have been Mika Häkkinen, but they were basically talking about like they have like family rallying, in you know, one of those Scandinavian countries where it's basically you have a rally course and you have all these old fucking beat up cars, and to stop people spending shitloads of money on the cars at the end of the race. You can walk up to a guy and tap him on the shoulder and say, swapsies, mate, and you have to swap.
Yeah.
So there's absolutely no incentive to fucking pimp out the car and just dominate because you've got better technology.
There was a rule like that in MotoGP. There was this second class of like, there were all the factories, but there weren't that many factories, a bit like LMP1's going through at the moment at Le Mans.
Mm.
So they had this open class, and it was basically... you could convert a superbike engine into a MotoGP, like a production engine into a superbike engine, and you could you build your own chassis. But the idea with the engines was that anybody could be able to come up with €10,000 and buy it off you. So it kind of cost capped it. You were never going to invest that much in the engine if someone could basically just say, look, you know, hand it over, bitch.
But I love that idea of some sort of equalization of the hardware, and then it comes down to, you know, the software, the people racing it. It's all about that. And if you're a really good racer, you know, you win a race and some dude comes and takes your car, and then you come back the next weekend and just win with that car that you got
given.
That's
true. Like, although part of motorsport is if you spec everything out and make everything identical, then you end up with processional racing. One of the cool things that motorsport fans like is where you've got cars or bikes that have got the same performance overall, but they make it in different ways. And maybe it's a little car that's nimble through the twisty stuff and a big car that's fast down the straights or something like that. And you get that kind of differential in performance that creates drama.
Mm.
Different ways and different tactics of developing speed. I mean, if the overall speed's the same, but you have different ways of arriving at that, that's actually kind of cool and tactical and interesting. And that's, you know, that's more interesting than watching V8 supercars follow each other around a car park.
Yeah. Well, this is the thing, like the next round of Crankworx is on this weekend. And I think one of the reasons I like the mountain biking so much is if it was a straight race where no one ever crashed, then, you know, obviously Brandon Semenuk's going to win every round. But because it's such a high-risk, high-reward, like...
Well, would it? Because, you know, then someone would fucking elbow him out the way. It's kind of like the difference between rally and rallycross. You actually have to compete elbow to elbow on a racetrack, then shit can go wrong that you wouldn't have expected. If you've got the track to yourself and the only competitor is your brain, and you can say, look, I'm just going to go out and go as hard as I can, and it's all under my control, that's fine. But if you get wiped out by some fucking hero diving up the inside of the first corner, that's a variable that you can't control for.
Well, and that's why I like the two-round format, because...
You like the round format? Are you an apologist for new Twitter? What's wrong with you, sir?
Mate,
I'm on TweetDeck. It's been around forever, as far as I can tell.
Yeah, I was going to say, I've been running a third-party app that's had round avatars for fucking ever. I was like, what the fuck are you people talking about? But no, the thing about the two rounds, like Crankworx and Rampage, is the pressure that it puts on you. Like an unknown or a lesser guy throwing down a massive run or landing a massive run in the first round absolutely puts the pressure on for the better guys to try tricks that they probably weren't comfortable at trying.
Yeah, absolutely.
In the first round.
This is a bit like...
And then if they crack...
If you drop... And I always pull this comparison because I watch a lot of surfing. If you drop a really good wave on your first crack, suddenly shit gets real all up and down the lineup. It changes the game for everybody else involved.
I think
great win for Wilco at Fiji over the weekend, by the way.
Oh, okay, yeah. You're saying what was the top five competitors got wiped out in the first round or something?
Yeah, like all the guys up the pointy end, the top five guys in the title race, all got knocked out in the first couple of rounds. So it was
amazing.
Matt Wilkinson, who won the first two rounds last year. And my favourite surfer, Parco, because he surfs like an old man, even though he's a little bit younger than me. Now, he does. He's got this kind of really kind of – he's got a bit of dad bod going on, and he's got this kind of lazy, loping kind of style, but it's just so graceful, and it's always on time. You know, when he carves through, it's just perfectly – if you watch Parco, you're like, yeah, that guy surfs. That's exactly what you want. You see these young kids who are just – flailing and flashing like a fucking fencer trying to carve the bark off a tree, but Parco just always looks like he's in control of shit. And now I've always enjoyed watching him surf. So I'm always like, and the same reason I like watching Tyler Wright surf on the girl side, on the women's side. Sorry, folks. It's that same kind of I'm always in control of my shit, and that's just how that rolls. Parco dropped out in the semis, but Wilco ended up winning against young Shire rookie Connor O'Leary. If O'Leary had won, it would have made Luke Egan, former World Tour pro and cousin of the Johns brothers, I think. Coach, because he coached. He's involved on the World Tour as the coach of Courtney Conlogue, who's this really good Californian women's surfer, and she won the women's Fiji Pro. And if Conor O'Leary had won the men's, then he would have had the full set, which is quite impressive.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, his other half, Jess Yates, is the host of the V8 Supercars. So there's a sporting family that you wouldn't expect. Shouts to them.
That's a fairly broad sporting family. All right. Have you got any other hot sporting takes for me?
Let's go quickfire. Despite all that fucking carbon fiber valley expertise the Brits recruited for their America's Cup campaign, they fucking lost. So fuck you. Turns out Adrian Newey built them at 2017 Red Bull of a boat, which is kind of shit, really.
Well, the other one is, despite holding a meaningless one-day tournament in your country where it rains every fucking second day, they still managed to lose in the semifinals. So,
no, it's in their country. It's not in my country.
Mm, that's what I said.
No, you said in my country. Not in my fucking country.
I said, like, England hosting the...
Nobody cares about the ICC pointless trophy thing.
Trophy, whatever. Actually,
pay your talent, you fucking cheap pricks.
I had a little exchange with an English journalist about, you know, basically you're saying Australia was shit.
A needle exchange. We're saying they don't care, because who cares?
It's like, mate, there's only one-day tournament that counts. It's the World Cup, and we won it. So who gives a fuck whether we got knocked out in the rounds of another meaningless one-day tournament? No one cares. You might care because it's in England and your side's doing better than they've done
before. You're a cricket commentator.
And then the next.
And by the way, you're going to lose to India. I think India are in the final, so I'm going to assume they're going to win.
No, Pakistan beat them, which is just the most Pakistan thing is going out and getting flogged by India in the rounds. Like, literally... like comically fielding, missing.
How many games? When are they play like a game every night? Because I'm sure I saw India beat Bangladesh like this morning.
Yes, that was the other semi-final. So Pakistan beat England.
Oh, yeah, well that's fine. Pakistan should beat England because England is shit.
So you get an India-Pakistan final.
Well, that'll be uncontroversial. I'm sure nothing will amount from that.
And it'll probably get rained out after 28.
Yes, because it's England.
Because it's
England is fucking rubbish.
In fucking spring. I suppose it's early summer, I guess.
Yeah, but early summer is still winter. It's England. Mm. It's really rubbish. Just going back to laugh at Britain a bit more. They literally, Ben Ainslie recruited Adrian Newey and ProDrive, and his boat still sucks, so fuck him. New Zealand have strolled through to the oh shit not Oracle again round, so they're going to start sailing for the America's Cup itself. I think it's Sunday morning, but don't let that distract you from the fact that Team New Zealand blew an 8-1 lead in the finals.
That's a very nice tie-in to the start of our podcast.
Yes. Because I looked that up. I was like, did they blow an 8-1 lead last time? Yes, they fucking did. But the Challenger final was delayed for a few hours because of bad wind. They obviously need to have more fibre. And by comparison, the World Surf League took an entire week off in Fiji because the surf wasn't big enough, which felt like an excuse just to hang out on a private surf island. All expenses paid for a bit. You and I are definitely in the wrong line of work.
That's all right.
I think
we should start a surfing podcast and see whether we can get invited.
Yeah. Well, a dude I went to school with is one of the top surf photographers. We've never exchanged a fucking word since, but never got on at the time. But I always, whenever I see his byline, I'm like, ah, shit, it's old mate. He was never my mate because he was a cop. But I'm sure he's a lovely dude now. Channel 10. Tits up. Well, Channel 10 might be going tits up, or it might just be, I reckon it's probably more a case of major shareholders are letting it die so they can swoop in once the cross-media ownership laws are slackened enough for Uncle Rupert yeah, and old mate Bruce Gordon to dive in.
There's a bit of political maneuvering there, isn't
there? For
sure,
they're pushing lots of pressure on them to change the cross, because currently nobody called Murdoch can own Channel 10 because somebody called Murdoch owns every paper in every single paper town in Australia, which is fair enough because Murdoch is a toxic fucktard. But the problem is that if Channel 10 is allowed to die, it currently holds the rights to a whole lot of free-to-air sport that will then probably dribble back onto the market. We looked into this and sort of looked at the question of Aaron Riley popped it up on Twitter and said, you know, what is the story if Channel 10 goes bust and what happens to the rights? And it is a little bit league and competition specific, but a lot of the sport that Channel 10 has the rights to, with the exception of the Big Bash League, are things that they've been on sold the free-to-air component from Fox. So it, like the MotoGP, Formula One, V8 Supercars, and coming up the A-League. So that would renege back to, I think renege's the right word, that would revert to Fox, and Fox would have to find another free-to-air vendor to take that on, particularly in the case of stuff that's covered by the anti-siphoning rules, like Bathurst, because Bathurst has to be on free-to-air television.
Which is what I said, imagining the Australian government to have modern fucking sensibilities about internet and media is ridiculous.
If you can imagine Australia had an internet,
the
solution would be, as you said, fucking stream it, and then everyone gets it.
That's right. Say, we're going to stream it for free. Yeah. This is free. Like, everybody, like, as many people now have a computer as a TV.
We'll have ads and safety core periods. The end.
Yeah, and you know, run the Fox commentators. It's still on Foxtel if you want to watch it on a fucking 102-inch television, whatever fucking cashed-up bogans have in their houses.
Fuck you! I've got a nice television.
I don't. I've got a shitty small Kogan TV because I don't watch television.
Well, I say television. It's really just a monitor. It's a monitor that Sky is plugged into, and the Chromecast is plugged into. Actually, it's not bad. We absolutely screwed JB Hi-Fi properly hard and got like $300 off the price of a telly. And I'm glad because it turns out JB are cones. But it does have an app that picks up YouTube, which is kind of cool. I can stream YouTube straight from my laptop to the television, which is kind of cool.
I was going to save this for the After Dark, but I was one of the guys at work. He's like, I guess he's like, he's a boomer, but like the older end of boomers, I guess. But he's a massive baseball fan. And
what's
and
the older end of boomer like, other than dead?
I don't know. Like 60? 65.
Well, the oldest boomers. Well, my dad is the upper limit of as old a boomer can be because he was literally born in 1946. And the point of baby boom is that it was post war, so the war has to have finished for the boom to start.
So he's
68.
So he's
70, 68. Fuck off. 70. And my God, my dad's 71. How did he get so old?
Yeah. Okay. So he's firmly in the middle of boomerish.
Excuse me while I have an existential crisis.
So he was we had I told him that we did Sergeant Pepper's for last week's After Dark. So we had a very interesting discussion about Sergeant Pepper, which he agreed is not the strongest Beatles album. He's a massive Beatles fan, as you would imagine.
We'll talk about this in the After Dark, but it has been nice that Beatles fans have popped up and said, you know, you actually said things that were bang on. We've had some Beatles fans that didn't quite say quite so much along those lines, but yeah. We didn't say they were cunts. We just said this is not the best of their work. But we'll get to that.
But anyway, I said
about that in about 20 minutes, which in your time is about 3 days.
He's got a massive television, but he watches the MLB at bat on the iPad, and I said, look, mate, just get a Chromecast or an Apple TV and plug it into your huge screen and run the MLB at bat app on your TV.
Literally, I've been watching Le Mans. Is my phone has the app, and I've just been streaming it from the phone to my Chromecast, and it's on this big fuck off screen. It looks gorgeous.
Anyway, let's wrap it up. Wrap it up. Come back. Talk some
let's
tunes.
Let's do the VAT.
I'll keep saying this because we keep getting people interact with us on Twitter and Facebook.
Shit. You know what I forgot to mention? And I have to mention this. Yeah. I have to mention what I felt like on Tuesday. On Tuesday was the day before the British and Irish Lions were due to play the Highlanders. And I tweeted, this is meaningless reserve grade shit. It's fucking patronising that they expect us to care. We've got 9 players out because of all the other games. And this is a fucking B-grade midweek dirt tracker line selection. And they expect us to go down to that fucking overpriced plastic fucking lunchbox that we've already paid for with our rates that cost $100 and change million that I'm going to be paying for as long as I live in this fucking city. They expect us to turn up and pretend to care. This is a load of fucking shit. Why the fuck? I mean, it's fucking bread and circuses, man. This meaningless, pointless fucking midweek Thursday night game between the Highlanders and the fucking Lions. Complete load of wank. And then the Highlanders won by a point. Otago Highlanders! That's our name! So my attitude changed a little bit after that. The Lions are going to lose really badly in this test series to the All Blacks.
Have they won a game yet?
They beat the Crusaders, which is the best thing in the world. Oh, they also beat some pack of fucking provincial. It was a provincial 15 that were literally dudes who might not have even played for a province yet. Like a bunch of sheep farmers and out-of-work shearers and traffic cops from Palmerston and shit. But literally the only significant team they've beaten are the unbeaten Canterbury Crusaders, the team that have been leading the Super 14, the Super whatever we're up to, Super too many umteen. And that makes me deliriously happy because Crusaders fans are the worst and they lost to an exhibition team. Go fuck yourself.
Yeah, well,
with a brick.
If they get destroyed, which everyone thinks that they
will. Well, either Gatlin's playing his cards really close to his chest or they're going to get three lots of 30-point beatdowns.
Is that the end of the Lions?
Well, no, because then they'll play South Africa in 4 years and they'll beat them.
And they'll do all right. And they'll come back and toss Australia.
Beaten New Zealand once in all the times they've come down to New Zealand. It was like 71 or 77, and it was totally unexpected. You know, it was just luck of the draw. But they're about as good as the Wallabies. I mean, they beat the Wallabies last time they went over there. It's just, you know, this just in. New Zealand's good at rugby. Because they're the only country that gives a fuck. Just like the America's Cup, really.
And on that note, let's come back. Because if it's not the Balls podcast, it's not stating the fucking obvious.
Can we put that in Latin?
See ya.
Yeah, me too. No shit.